Welcome back to the Unknown Strength podcast, where we aim to provide you with insights into the fight game and the strength and conditioning training that translates to performance in the cage, ring, or on the mat. I'm your host, Brenton McKitterick, and joining me are my co-hosts, McGregor McNair and Stephen Phillips. So on today's episode, we talk at length with Luke Lehman and Zoe Knight, who are the strength and health optimization gurus behind MuscleNerds.net.
Yeah, Luke really is one of the world's foremost authorities on strength, health, and hormone optimization for athletes, but for general population as well. And his partner, Zoe Knight, is the managing director of the company, and she's also a goldmine of info on all this stuff as well.
That was an immense amount of information to digest. I've got a lot of takeaways from this. I was scribbling furiously throughout the podcast, so I will need to review it again to polish up on my notes. But
epic is all I can say. That was just epic. We're definitely going to have to split that interview into two parts. So this episode of the Unknown Strength podcast, episode 2, will be part 1 of the Luke Lehman and Zoe Knight interview. And in an upcoming episode will be part 2.
Excellent. So thanks, and we hope you enjoy the podcast, and we just want to say thanks for the intro song to Fuck the Fitzroy Doom Scene.
Enjoy the interview, everyone. Okay, thank you so much for joining us, the Unknown Strength podcast. We have Brenton, Steve, and myself, Mac, and very special guests with us tonight. We have Luke Lehman and Zoe Knight from Muscle Nerds. How are you guys going?
Good.
Good, guys. How are we doing?
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Fantastic.
So, Luke and Zoe, you guys are the head honchos and the partners in crime behind Muscle Nerds, Inc. Why don't you start off by telling us how you both met?
You know what?
That's a funny story.
This is Zoe's story, so I'll let her tell this.
No, I actually went to one of Luke's biosignature courses in Sydney when he was here a few years ago. I didn't like him when I first met him. I've told the story so many times.
Well, please give it to us again.
I thought he was really rude and arrogant and just not nice. But we actually didn't have much to do with each other all during the course. And I've been based in Brisbane for the last 8 years, and he then travelled down to the Gold Coast to stay with a mutual friend of ours. And then he added me on Facebook and asked me on a date, and I said no for about 2 weeks. And he was persistent as all hell.
Of course,
now that I know him, is there any other way? But I finally just caved in. Long story short, our dinner date lasted 4 days.
Wow.
I then proceeded to quit both of my jobs and sell my car, and then I flew to America. And whilst I was over there, Luke finished up a Polycon group, so we both found ourselves jobless and we started Muscle Nerds. So that's a really Reader's Digest version, like a really
version. The PG but version.
But that's in summary how we met.
Fantastic. And you guys have both taken Muscle Nerds all around the world over the last couple of years. Can you tell us some of the different cities you've presented Muscle Nerds so far? Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, I actually wrote a list out earlier, and I was like, holy shit, you know, we've been all over Australia, obviously, but we've also been to Dublin, and I've been to London a few times, Manchester, all over the United States, all over Canada, Montreal, Toronto, New York, Los Angeles, Essex. We've been all over the place.
Yeah, we did. We went to Dubai, Kuwait, New Zealand, the main places in Australia, and I think that's kind of really it. Toronto.
We're going to be going to Singapore and Hong Kong. We added that in this year.
Yep. Next month we go there.
I'm hoping Poland and Amsterdam as well.
Terrific. Man, that is a full schedule.
It's ridiculous. And do you know what? When you start planning out this stuff, it makes a year so short. Like 12 months is just, it's
gone.
And it's nothing. It's not long enough.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
It's pretty full on and hectic.
Yeah. So moving on from that, Luke and Zoe, you guys and I have had a little bit to do with each other over the years, mainly due to Luke's years as PICP and biosignature instructor at the Poliquin Group. Now, a lot of our listeners don't have much exposure to strength and health education circles like Poliquin Group, for example. So For those listeners, why don't you tell us a bit about your background, how you got started on your path, and a little bit about your journey to where you guys are today.
All right. Yeah. So I started lifting weights when I was around 8 years old or so. So I had that was back when Arnold Schwarzenegger had come out with Conan the Barbarian. And I saw Arnold and I was like, I've got to be like that. I want to be Arnold. Right. So my parents bought me a little weight set and I just kept collecting weights and lifting weights. And then, you know, Texas football started. So we lifted weights all through that. I started competing in powerlifting when I was 14. That's about when I heard of Charles Poliquin as well, with the old Muscle Media magazine. And then after that, T-Mag. So yeah, T-Nation. So, you know, just kept on with it and was fortunate enough later to go and get my PSCP-1 and my Biosig-1. And I just kept going. So I did the Biosig-1, 2, 3, did a bunch of the special consideration courses. And around 2010, I believe, I started working for them, doing some assistant teaching and then eventually going on as one of the head instructors.
And I just want to also add in there that Luke is a weirdo.
Oh, fantastic. Like we didn't know that already.
And an arrogant
right,
asshole.
But throughout that whole period, he's also just got his head buried in like books and courses and education. Like I don't think there's a day that goes by that he's not studying or researching or learning. So that's another, I think that would be one of the biggest factors as to how he got where he is today, is just his absolute passion and dedication to learning.
Yep.
But yeah.
I'm just an old school meathead, man.
And so Zoe, everyone knows that behind a great man is a great woman. Why don't you tell us about yourself and your journey?
Well, I'm just going to start off by saying that Luke's actually the woman in the relationship.
Yes, that's true.
No, well, I'm actually nowhere near as deep into the industry as Luke is or was, but I actually only started even exercising myself when I moved to Australia in 2008, and it was a slow progress into this industry. I actually was, before I met Luke, one of those cardio bunnies. So I did boot camps and the box fit classes and all that sort of stuff.
All the fun stuff.
Yeah, all the stuff that you think you should be doing. But anyway, it's a whole other story. But I actually went to a boxing class once and the owner of the gym took it and he was phenomenal. And I remember going home that Saturday morning thinking, I want to be like him. Like, he was so awesome. And I got out of that shower from my session that Saturday morning. I emailed off some emails to some colleges, some fitness colleges. By that Wednesday, I was accepted into one. And the Thursday after that, I had already been offered a job as a personal trainer. Wow. So like within 4 days of deciding I wanted to do it and acting on it, my life completely went down a like the garden path, really. And I just ended up down in this industry. And I'm super, super inquisitive by nature. So it wasn't enough for me just to know, okay, this is what you should be doing. I'm like, but why? And then that's what led me to Biosig and then meeting Luke and here we are.
Fantastic. Well, that kind of leads on to our next question, which is to do with Muscle Nerds. Why don't you tell everybody what exactly is Muscle Nerds all about?
It's about
motor mouth.
Putting the health back in the health and fitness industry.
Yeah, so you know, look, I've been online training people, and I know that's a really cliche thing now, everybody's an online trainer. I've been doing it since about 2008, and we were doing that while I was working with Poliquin Group. And after working with Poliquin Group and kind of being in that that environment for over 10 years, I realized that there's a huge gap in the industry for general population. Like, there's it seems like every certification out there that you do after you get your original cert is all about high performance training and
athletes and
high crazy fat loss super compensation boot camps with hypertrophy stuff, and everything's geared around high level athletes. And what I found was that the coaches that were trying to use that on their general population, it just doesn't work. It works for, you know, 30% of the population, but it doesn't work for the other 70. So they were trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. So we decided, well, what's the main difference? Well, your general population of people simply aren't athletes. They have a job and they have a mortgage and they have kids and a dog and two cars and they've got stress and, you know, they're overworked and they're under recovered and they eat like shit. And you just can't take them in the gym and beast their asses and think that you're going to force them to get lean and force them to grow muscle. It just doesn't work like that. So, you know, we decided that we wanted to kind of go in, start telling people, look, your clients are stressed. This is how you see the stress. This is how you work on the stress. And this is how you fit in all of the programming. And this is how you do proper nutrition. So we're trying to get rid of all the bullshit that people are doing and get them on the right track to training Joe Schmo and Mary Muffintop.
I also decided, like I also said to Luke when he started writing our level one course, that I don't want to do anything that doesn't have an education aspect to it. So I think that's another important concept. In this industry, there's so many facts that are thrown around, but not many people understand those facts or understand the why. So we try and have some form of education aspect to almost every service or product that we have.
Fantastic. I find that actually really refreshing from doing research on the both of you, that I guess one of the phrases that you both throw around is that health first, performance second. So specifically in the fight game, how do you think some of the coaches are getting this wrong with their fighters?
Well, when you look at the fight game, and I come from a martial arts background where, you know, I started out with traditional type of martial arts, the usual stuff, Taekwondo, Hapkido, Kajikembo, stuff like that. And mm-hmm. eventually went into things like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and into Muay Thai. And the gyms that I was training at in Dallas, there was a lot of pro fighters training there. And one of the number one things, they just simply trained with far too much volume. Like these guys will come in and they'll do, you know, 4 mile run in the morning, and then they'll come in, they'll do all their skill work for 3 or 4 hours. Sparring, then they'll go to the gym and lift weights, and they'll go for another run, then they'll go and they'll train some more, and they'll teach some more. And it's like these guys have like 16 hour days where they never get a chance to slow down and rest and actually do any recovery, and they focus on too much of the wrong things. You know, there's only a handful of coaches that I know, a handful of real strength conditioning coaches that really understand this stuff, which is like the guys at the ISI, John Connor, who is Conor McGregor's coach. He's a champ at this stuff. And we also love Joel Jameson's work as far as his conditioning and learning how to the different types of adaptations that you should be working for, other than just having people do road work and having them do sprints just for the sake of it.
Yeah, fantastic. And I think another thing you guys talk about is, you know, your recovery being proportionate to, you know, how hard you can train being proportionate to how much you can recover. I find that really interesting.
Well, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, if you're in a recovery deficit and you're not getting better, you're getting worse. There's no such thing as homeostasis. The body will try to maintain homeostasis, but you're either moving forward or you're moving backwards. So if you're not measuring and assessing things, then you can't manage any things. You only manage what you measure, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we use things like heart rate variability, waking heart rate, blood pressure. We use a lot of the stress questionnaires and interviewing and things like that to decide and determine, is this too much volume for my client? Is this too much intensity? Are they able to recover? If they're not recovering, there's no point in doing work just for work's sake.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess honing in on more of a sort of a health narrative here, something I've noticed that's become increasingly a discussion point is that of gut health. And when I'm doing my own research, it's estimated that 90% of the body's serotonin is being produced in the digestive tract. So it would seem obvious that keeping the gut healthy would be absolutely paramount. So a lot of recommendations I've seen for L-glutamine primarily as a gut cleansing benefit, which is something that Mac put me onto. So in this regard, I was just wondering perhaps your thoughts on gut health and what do you consider when you're training athletes?
Well, yeah, so L-glutamine is important, you know, taking down 10 to 15 grams. You look at some of the things that it does in the gut as far as feeding the immune system and things. As far as a serotonin, a lot of people will talk about that 90% of the serotonin and they'll correlate it with depression and anxiety. So we have to understand that the serotonin in your gut is there for different reasons than what's in your brain. So those are a little bit two different conversations. However, we do know that the gut and the brain have a connection through the vagus nerve. So if you're not making serotonin in the gut, it's been theorized that you possibly could have issues with depression because certain types of bacteria will cause your brain behavior. It'll cause behavior issues, manic depressiveness, and things like that. So gut, at the foundation of everything, especially with fighting and in athletics, the gut is a huge, huge deal. And how many fighters do we know that have fucking bubble guts all the time?
Yeah.
You see it if you ever go to a fight. You see the stuff behind the curtain when they're trying to weigh in and they've been depleting themselves. And then the first thing they do is they don't eat healthy food. They go down to the bar and get some pasta or they get some fucking donuts trying to replenish themselves. And then they've got diarrhea and green apple splatters.
But
I'll say, at the end of the day, this is what we teach. Everything has to do with stress, everything. So when you're stressed, your guts get more permeable. When that happens, you get immune system dysregulation. It causes more stress and more inflammation. Then you can't recover, and it causes a host of other issues.
Yeah, amazing. So,
everything.
Yeah,
there's nothing really that the gut doesn't affect.
Exactly. So if you're not taking care of your gut, you're not really taking care of your health at all.
Yeah, amazing. So, I mean, that leads on to my next question, which would be about, I guess, a growing interest in inflammation. It's something, again, I'm seeing more and more. And so what do you think athletes need to be aware of or concerned with in regards to the nutritional inflammation?
You start looking at things like if it fits your macros and start looking at their choices of foods and their quality. And, you know, we teach something that we've got from James Laval when I was mentored under him is basically garbage in, garbage out. And everything that you eat is going to have either a positive or a negative consequence on your body and on your mind. So if they continue to eat things that are inflammatory to nutritionally, it's going to cause inflammation overload, which is going to, again, cause issues with recovery and stress and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess moving on from that. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, inflammation isn't a bad thing. You need it, right? So you need stress and you need inflammation. The problem is the majority of the population, they're already so stressed out and so inflamed that then they add in training on top of that, and then they add in some dieting and the possible nutrient deficiencies because they're not eating enough, and then you get unmitigated inflammation. It gets out of control, and then you start getting joint pain, you start getting permeable guts and things like that.
Yeah, so it's a vicious cycle.
It starts manifesting everywhere else.
Everywhere.
And that's another thing I think that's really important about gut health is a lot of the symptoms that bad gut health causes, majority of people wouldn't link it to being a gut issue, if that makes sense. So like the symptoms that they're getting, it could be the skin and their mood and their performance levels and that they can't sleep properly, energy levels, all that sort of stuff. And you'd never think, oh man, I've got to go work on my gut. You'd think, okay, I've got to fix my skin.
That's the last thing you'd think of.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. It's funny, though, how historically we've always referred to things as a gut feeling, and yet the science is now demonstrating that really important relationship to the brain.
Well, between that vagus nerve, I've read some stuff that says that, so obviously it's bidirectional. The communication between your brain and your gut down your vagus nerve is from your gut to your brain or your brain to your gut. They think a lot of people are starting to say that the communication is more gut to brain than brain to gut, which is really interesting.
Wow, that is.
So sugar, or at least refined sugar, again, is something that's increasingly being linked to inflammation. So I was wondering what your thoughts on that. I mean, among a host of other problematic issues, personally, I have an insatiable appetite for sweets, and particularly what I consider Australia's delicacy, which is Tim Tams.
Oh, same.
So if I'm honest, I mean, I do struggle with a bit of cognitive dissonance when it comes to sugar. I love sweets, but deep down I know it's probably not the best thing for my body. So as I learn more about sugar and its role in inflammation, I realize I probably need to moderate my intake. So do you have anything that you could add on this topic that could perhaps incite a bit more fear in me and get me off sugar for good?
Well, I'll tell you, sugar isn't really the problem, right? The problem, when you look at carbohydrates and sugars, the problem is people's bodies, right? Again, you have high levels of stress. Stress will shut down insulin receptors, making you more insulin resistant, which will cause hyperinsulinemia. In somebody who has very, very low stress and is, you know, training and dieting and all that, sugar shouldn't be a problem. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about, you know, banging out bags of lollies, right? Or Tim Tams. Because when you look at this, you're looking at things that have calories, have sugar, but have no actual nutrition. So, you know, when you're eating a piece of fruit, you have a lot of cofactors and vitamins and minerals in the fruit that actually help to digest the fruit, whereas when you're eating a Tim Tam, you don't have that, right? In a lot of cases, they'll enrich them with extra vitamins, but, you know, if you were manufacturing Tim Tams, would you put the best pharmaceutical-grade vitamins and minerals in the Tim Tam, or would you be buying the nastiest bulk shit you could get out of China?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, which in a lot of cases, those vitamins end up being anti-vitamins. They actually make you worse because we'll take like folic acid, for instance. Folic acid isn't everything. When you it's not something you typically find in nature. You find folate in nature. So if you eat some spinach or some kale or whatever, you're finding folate, which is very easy for the body to convert. When you look at folic acid, in a lot of people, they don't have the capacity to convert it chemically, so it can build up and cause some problems.
And also sugar can deplete the vitamins that you've got, especially I think magnesium is a big one where it takes like, what, 52 or 56 molecules of magnesium to process one molecule of sugar. So not only, like with our lifestyle, not only are we not getting in enough, our diet and lifestyle is also depleting what we do have. So it's kind of like a double whammy. But in regards to the cravings of sugar, like I think you need to get to the root cause as to why you're craving it. Because there's so many different reasons as to why people could be have an insatiable appetite for sugar. What is it that's causing you to need it or feel like you want it so bad? Because I'm the same. I'm the biggest sweet tooth. I've been my sweet my whole life, whereas Luke's a fat guy. Like he loves fat. And there's different reasons as to why we like that.
Well, yeah. So if we go back to our talk on serotonin, if we look at how tryptophan crosses into the blood-brain barrier, you need insulin basically to remove large neutral amino acids that are competing with it across the blood-brain barrier, right? So when we eat sugar or we eat carbohydrates and we increase insulin, that allows tryptophan to pass over, which then it can be converted into 5-hydroxytryptophan and then into 5-hydroxytryptamine or serotonin, and then it can be turned into melatonin. So a lot of the times when people are craving like that, in a lot of cases, you find that craving and you find depression, and then you also find things like night eating syndrome where, you know, maybe you don't eat that much during the day, but after 6 or 7 o'clock, you become like the cookie monster and you'll eat anything that's not nailed down, especially sugar, right? And in that case, adding something like a little bit of 5-HTP with a little B6 is a really good strategy because it'll cut your carb cravings down and it'll allow you to make more serotonin, more melatonin, so you'll actually sleep better.
But you also need to be careful about giving 5-HTP to anybody that's on
an antidepressant, on an SSRI. Right. Yeah. So I want to give.
I was going to say, is there a certain time that functions better if taking 5-HTP with B6?
It depends because some people need more than others. And what we find is that if you give too large of a bolus dose of it, it can have the opposite effect. So we'll typically tell people a daily dose of around 25 to 200 milligrams of 5-HTP. Almost every time that I've had somebody take the big bolus dose, they actually get insomnia and they get irritable. So if we're going to give them a lot, we always start with the lowest effective dose. So we start with 25 milligrams, maybe do that at dinner. See how you feel. If it's not working, maybe you add 25 milligrams to lunch or, you know, one big 50 milligram dose, and you increase the dose until you get a positive result, and then you stop there. And if you ever get a negative result, you bring the dose back down. This is a huge subject with all this type of stuff, especially with neurotransmitters. And you get a lot of trainers, they take a seminar and they learn about a couple of neurotransmitters and they go out like they're a damn neuroscientist and none of them know what the fuck they're talking about.
Dangerous to mess with.
It can be very, there's some safe things you can do, but you know, people using like the Braverman test, which is a subjective shit. Like it's the worst thing you could possibly take to try to tell somebody what neurotransmitters are dominant and what they're deficient in. Right. So like, and it's a very popular, test for people to take, but it's super subjective. Like if we were all hanging out at the strip club and we railed off some crystal meth off a hooker's ass, we'd all be dopamine dominant, right? But if we go to Baskin Robbins and we ate a fucking liter of ice cream, we'd all be serotonin dominant. So it's all right. Very, very subjective.
Yeah.
Guys, Mac recently wrote an article about minimum effective dose, and in that article he makes reference to least mode, which is one of your concepts. So a great opportunity to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. What the hell's least mode, and how can that apply to fight athletes?
Well, you know, it's human nature, and for me, being an American, it's the American way. Like, more is better, big is better, blah blah blah. And what we have to realize is that not everybody needs to be beasted in the gym. Everybody, it's big. You know, the strength and conditioning industry is all alpha this, I'm so alpha bullshit, chest thumping stuff. So, you know, and people thrive off of crippling their athletes and crippling their general population clients. What we need to realize is that not everybody needs to do 30 sets of workout, and a lot of people, 8 to 10 sets could be a lot of training. So we have to be able to measure things so we can determine if it's an appropriate amount of exercise for them. Because we need to, I think it was Lee Haney that said, stimulate, don't annihilate, right? Mm. And again, if you're just annihilating people, you have a very poor understanding of physiology and how this stuff works.
I also think, so when with training, we're purposely raising our sympathetic nervous system. So we're purposely putting ourselves and elevating that fight or flight arm of the autonomic nervous system. When what you need to do to be balanced and to be getting results and to be healthy and all that sort of stuff, you need a balance of that in your parasympathetic nervous system. But nobody's ever actively trying to do anything to raise that parasympathetic nervous system. They're always just either trying to bring down the SNS without actually focusing on your PNS. So that's what I think least mode is as well, is balancing out that system with activities that purposely raise your PNS to bring you back into balance, if that makes sense.
Right. So another phrase that we coined is need to beast mode your least mode, which means if you're not going and getting massages, if you're not stretching, if you're not meditating, getting some type of aerobic base, taking some time, getting good sleep. If you're not sleeping, you have absolutely no reason to go in the gym and kill yourself. Okay. And the majority, like we train a ton of general population, and we train a ton of coaches. Like we train a lot of PICP coaches, BioSig coaches, coaches in other parts of the strength and conditioning. And the first thing they do is go, I can't sleep. What supplement should I take? Okay, you're training 14 fucking hours a week. You don't need any fucking pills. What you need to do is train 3 or 4 hours a week and chill out. And normally we get them that we do that. They cut it down to 3 or 4 hours, maybe add in a little bit of aerobics, maybe some stretching, or get some fucking yoga in your life. And, bingo bango, they start sleeping through the night. That's, and they feel like $1 million.
Another point there, though, is when you go to most personal trainers, they address your nutrition and your exercise. Very rarely do many trainers address anything outside of that, such as your lifestyle, your mental health. I mean, supplements is obviously now more so included than ever before. But there's more to it than just exercise and nutrition. There's far more to the picture that contributes to whether someone's going to get results or not. And they're very rarely addressed. So it's a whole other side to least mode. Like, there's so many different meanings to it, but they're all positive.
That's a really good point, Zoe. So I'll get to a question just around the general state of the health and fitness industry in a second, but I did want to just say, as someone who can occasionally be criticised as being inherently lazy, the least mode really stood out to me, because by doing less, we're forcing ourselves to be more well-rounded in our approach, right? So whether your trainer is forcing you to bust a gut, or you're pushing it on yourself because you're trying to out-train a bad diet or bad recovery and some of those other components that you called out, I think that's a really healthy approach. And it's something that, I mean, I'm 45. As I've gotten older and I've continued to lift heavier later on, I've had to be much more respectful for how I'm feeling and my own recovery, my central nervous system. The idea of having a deload week, for example, would have been completely foreign to me 5 years ago. And today I would say that, you know, even that sort of simple addition is what still keeps me in the gym today.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm in the same boat. I turn 39 next weekend, and I've been lifting since I was 8 years old. So I'm now getting to the point where I understand that more isn't better.
Luke, like, just wants to feel good.
Better is better. I just want to feel amazing. I like being able to sleep well. I've got shit tons of energy, and My lifts are all going up, and I'm making PRs in 5Ks. So, you know, it's all about balance. That's what we try to, to teach other coaches, is that's really what Lee Smoot is. It's about balance.
Well, there's a lot of conflicting information out there. A lot of different gyms I've trained at around the world, you see some gyms that train obsessively, where it's almost, they're almost brag about the fact that they're training 2 to 3 times a day, which is 6 hours total of just hard competition rounds. They're doing that 6 days a week, and it's almost this obsessive approach to, if you're not training, then the other guy at the other side of the world is training harder than you. And this is this really obsessive mindset that's instilled into a lot of students. And it can be really hard to sort of draw the line and say, you know, is what I'm doing actually counterproductive and counterintuitive to my growth and productivity? And is it actually going to hurt my or compromise my performance as opposed to enable it and improve it?
I think to me that just screams that they don't understand.
They don't, and it's old school thinking. It's like you're basically living a Rocky movie, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you're running out in the snow and your bare feet and chopping wood, and then you're going to the gym, and it's just like, it's
like they don't know what's going on when they're doing that, because if they did, they would be taking some risks.
But you're seeing a lot of new advanced stuff, because you see people like Conor McGregor, who you see him evolve every fight and get a little bit better, get a little bit faster, a little more powerful, a little more agile, a little better movement. And you're seeing a lot of this these days, where these guys are starting to get hip with, I need to have proper training, and if I want to last, you know, a long time in this, I need to be taking time off, and I can't burn myself out.
So what can you tell us about at the state of the health and fitness industry these days?
Yeah, where do we start? But I honestly think that the health and fitness industry promote to the health and fitness industry.
Yeah.
I think we're creating this really big divide between the people in the industry and the people who need to be in the industry. So like it's intimidating. Like, we're setting these unrealistic expectations, and the average Joe who's, you know, overweight and has 3 kids and all that sort of stuff, they look at us and they think that's unattainable. Like, I'm not even going to bother trying. That looks horrible. I don't want to do that. So I honestly think we promote, it's almost like a dick wagging contest, really.
Yeah.
Kind of like, look at me, like, I'm so hardcore. I've got a 6-pack. Well, I've got an 8-pack. Like, it's, we're not doing anything.
What do you call it? You call it 2 dicks.
Yeah. It's if you're a 2 dick. So it's kind of like, if a guy's like, I've got a dick, and the guy's like, well, I've got 2, you know, like, they just
I'll raise you one.
Yeah. So it's got, I honestly think it's gotten to that point, like, where it's just, we aren't making it comfortable for people who need us to approach us, if that makes sense.
Yeah. In a way, those people are being alienated by what's going
on.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it just looks so unattainable. Like, we put so much bullshit out there about, like, not many people are real about, they're not on 100% of the time. Like, too many people think that you're either 100% on or you're 100% off. Like, it's okay to, you know, just do a little bit and ease into it and take your time to build some habits and to do what you can do. Like, you don't have to go to bed on Sunday night and wake up Monday morning and completely change everything in your life. Like, it's, I don't know, it really winds me up.
you also have a lot of people coming out teaching courses that they have absolutely no reason to be teaching anything, because they're not teachers, and they're ripping off other people's work. And I see it all the time. And they're teaching things that aren't applicable. You know, they're repackaging PICP stuff and saying, oh, well, you can use this for personal training. That's not a personal training course. It's a high performance course. And that stuff really doesn't work that well for general population. And we started doing the Muscle Nerds courses because we wanted to teach a good foundational material, teach stress response, teach people the truth about what insulin is. Insulin is not evil. Insulin doesn't make you fat. Your management of carbohydrates and your stress levels are what's making you fat. It's what's making you sick. That's what's causing all the issues. And we're trying to teach very basic stuff in a very good way, because what I've found is, you have a lot of trainers talking out of their pay grade. They're taking courses they shouldn't be taking. They're courses that are too far advanced for what they know, and they
don't even have the basics right.
They don't even have the basics. They go and they do a hypertrophy workshop that teaches all of these really hardcore advanced programs, and they can't even write a basic fucking workout.
We teach knowledge, not systems, if that makes sense. Like, we don't, and I think every single coach that's come to any of our courses is an amazing coach. And I think the reason is we're attracting the people that genuinely want to learn and understand. They don't want to, like Luke says, a turnkey system where you come and you slot all your clients into this step A, step B, step C. Like, we're teaching knowledge so people can actually understand and be critical thinkers,
right?
Not just a non-thinking system where they can just make a bucket load of money from. It's, yeah, because of that, we're attracting awesome people.
The thing is, everybody is so biochemically different, physiologically different, you can't put them all in a system. That's why you have 25 to 30% of people making really awesome results, and then the rest of your clients aren't. I had someone ask me the other day, you know, you've got all these companies that show hundreds of before and afters, and well, how are they having such success? Well, you know, if you look at all of these different companies, they all have like 75 fucking trainers, and that all those trainers train like 15 people at a time. And you think about these companies being around for a long time, they're only showing you the success. They're not showing you the thousands of people that they didn't do fuck all for. And it's just like Instagram and Facebook. You see all the highlights of people's lives, and you don't see any time that they're just completely fucked, because people don't – well, some people put their drama on, but most people don't. So if you were to look at everybody's lives, you think everybody's having this fucking rainbow Skittle life, and that's not the case. And it's a lot of smoke and mirrors in the industry where you have trainers showing like 15 to 20 really good before and afters, but they're not telling you that they didn't do fuck all for the other 200 that aren't on any drugs and are like real normal people.
Yeah, so you end up propagating that social media jealousy where people feel that other people's lives are a highlight reel. Everything is the best it ever was.
And that you think that they're way more successful than they are. When we have a class and we show before and afters, I don't show any of our competitive powerlifters, or we don't show any of our competitive physique athletes.
Genetically gifted ones.
We don't show any of our clients that could possibly be on performance enhancing drugs. We only show normal people, somebody that could be your neighbor, because that's what really matters. When you're teaching general population training, you have to show people this is what's realistic in 4 weeks, 12 weeks, a year, not this candy-coated shit you see on Instagram.
Like, I kind of understand how the industry got to this point. Like they're really just marketing to people's desires of wanting instant gratification in the easiest way there.
Insta-famous.
Yeah, but also, like, the mark of a good trainer used to be they could get good transformations, right, like good results. And then the mark of a good trainer was like, well, I can get them fast. So people don't want to work hard and they don't want to wait for it. So of course you're going to start advertising to that. Of course you're going to start saying, okay, well, here's a 10-day challenge and I promise you results. Like, come on.
Yep, 7-minute abs.
Yeah, but yeah. I get why it's gotten to that point. It's because we're actually marketing to people's, like, laziness, I suppose.
Well, and then you're throwing people that they're too stressed out to be thrown into an 8-week challenge, yeah, a 10-day challenge, a 12-week or whatever. They need to be prepped to do that, and then you fuck them up, and then we have to iron out your problems because you've gotten so depleted and so fucked up because of hardcore dieting and shit tons of anaerobic training and not balancing that out, and now people's metabolisms are screwed and we have to teach and fix them.
Like, we're not completely against the time-framed programs or transformations that are out there, but I do think the danger in that, though, is that you're putting an end date on health, where there is no time frame on health, there is no end date. It should be a lifestyle change that you should work towards finding something sustainable that they can do for the rest of their lives, not just for 8 weeks.
It'd be a wonderful world if the before and afters, instead of showing someone's physiques, if you showed their labs, because yeah, I get to see everyone's bloods and see what's actually happening on their internal chemistry. And they look really nice on the outside, and they look horrid, like appallingly horrid on the inside. Yeah.
Apparently, health doesn't sell, though.
Health doesn't sell.
So. Yeah, people are only reactive to their health. They're not often proactive. So it's not until that they have to sort their shit out that they sort their shit out. It's not what sells. The image sells. The short, you know, work. The short time frame sell, the easy way sell. So
summer body sells.
That's something I've noticed increasingly in the health and fitness industry, is that it's increasingly so sold. The image is sort of marketed, you know, the result through the image, as opposed to, as you've highlighted, the actual healthiness of the athlete or the person, or just that general person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But who wants to care about that? No, people don't even realize how bad they're feeling. They don't even know that they feel like shit because they've got nothing to compare it to. So they don't think they need it. They just want to look good.
Mm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Luke, in the introduction at the start of this interview, you mentioned a number of martial arts. Can you tell us a little bit about your exposure to jiu-jitsu or any of the other martial arts that you've experienced?
Yeah, so, man, I fell in love with martial arts when I was like a kid. You know, I grew up in the age of Bruce Lee and in the, you know, ninja movies. Ninja movies were huge, right? So, you know, obviously every young man wanted to be a ninja. So, you know, we started out with, I come from a small town, so there wasn't a really big market. So you would have a guy, he would come in, he would teach for like 18 months, be losing his ass, not making any money. He would leave and somebody else would come in. So I had a lot of exposure to a lot of different things, just never long enough in anything, right? You get halfway through a system and the guy would leave. So did, Tiger Claw Kempo, Taekwondo, Hapkido. I've done judo for a while, Japanese Jiu-Jitsu, and, you know, then kind of stopped that for a while and replaced it with things like football and went to college and got into a guy called Kajikembo, which was just like a fucking hodgepodge of a bunch of different stuff. But so then later on, I decided to try out BJJ, and I walked in and I started training, and at like three or four sessions in, I was rolling with a guy. He was on top of me. He's just about 150K sweaty fat dude. And his nipple came out of his gi and went in my mouth, and that was my last Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu class, and I went to Muay Thai instead.
And, look, I'll tell you, it gets better.
Yeah, basically was getting my ass kicked by Seiksan Jinjira, who is all of 140 fucking pounds soaking wet, kicking me, and I'm holding a pad, and it feels like somebody's hitting me in the leg with a baseball bat, so I ended up, I really enjoyed that. I wasn't in it very long, but then I ended up moving back to Austin and, you know, kind of fell out of it. But I think we're going to take up boxing or something. You got to get into something.
Yeah,
I'm
doing kickboxing.
Yeah.
So I've had no, you know, competition experience unless you count street fights, but.
Sure. So how about you, Zoe? Do you have any martial arts experience in your background?
Not really. I did karate when I was little. I would have been like 7 for about a year. And then I've just, like I mentioned earlier, when I was the cardio bunny, it was just the box fit classes. So nothing overly technical, unfortunately. Sure. I mean, Luke tries to hip throw me every time I get too close. So I don't know, does that count?
Yeah, I think that would definitely count for something.
The compliant training partner.
So can you tell us a bit about your experience working with wrestlers or with jiu-jitsu guys or mixed martial arts athletes recently?
Well, to be honest, like my direct experience hasn't been that where I'm in the weight room coaching them, but I do a lot of consultations and we do a lot of internships with the guys that are working with the athletes direct. So, you know, basically what you have to do is break down the needs of every discipline, right? So, example, like for boxers, you need a lot of scapular strength. You need a lot of external rotation strength, things like that, because if their external rotators and scapular are really weak, then it's going to inhibit their ability to punch as hard and as fast as possible because they don't have a decelerator. So you know, you look at things like incline pressing, push jerks, stuff to build strength through their hips for punching. Judo requires a lot of lat strength because it's a lot of upper body throws and it's a lot of turning of the shoulders, and that's dictated by how strong your lats are. So and a lot of grip strength. I know you guys want to talk a little bit about grip strength, and I'll tell you, as far as the most gnarly grips I think I've ever experienced are judokas, man. Guys in judo have the most ridiculous grips I've ever experienced.
Oh, man, absolutely.
It complete, like, nothing. It's nothing like anything else you've ever ever experienced,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yep, I've been there.
But one of the things, like, for conditioning, you know, management of lactate production. So getting them, what I do, a lot of what we do at Muscle Nerds is I work on energy production. So if I can push and delay lactate buildup and drive things towards pyruvate metabolism, that's always a benefit, because what happens when you start building up lactate, you can't contract your muscles anymore and you lose your grip.
So is that what contributes to, I guess, you know, the soreness and general fatigue? I mean, that's something that invariably plagues all athletes, and it's, I guess it's a particular challenge of mine that I deal with regularly, trying to balance strength sessions with, you know, days and hours and upon hours of hard competition rounds. I find that, you know, everything's pretty sore, especially after a brutal squat session when I need the support of the handrails to navigate a bathroom. So what are your thoughts on managing this when you consider the needs of a fight sport athlete and balancing that with actual strength training?
Well, you know, you have to look at everything in one, and what we find is people focus far too much on the anaerobic side of things and they don't do enough for the aerobic side. So something I picked up from Joel Jameson is that, you know, we are primarily aerobic animals, right? So that lactate building pathway is basically a fight or flight pathway. That is, you know, we're either fighting an animal, which is what you're doing when you're in competition or when you're in practice, or you're running away, right? So if we can utilize some aerobic work and keep the autonomic nervous system balanced, we can keep that lactate from building up as quickly, and we can make more energy faster. When you look at things like nutrient deficiencies, like B vitamins, we look at things like beta alanine is a really good one. Beta alanine, we can use different types of bicarbonates and things like that to keep that lactate driven down. And also understand that the more stressed out you are and the more overtrained you are and the less recovery you have, the more your body's just going to produce lactate doing nothing. And we find that a lot where we'll do an organic acids test on someone and their lactate is sky high and their pyruvate is really low. And then when you look at all the cofactors in the Krebs cycle, they're low because they don't have any pyruvate entering that process. So they're not making energy appropriately. If that's the case, and that's just them sitting down doing nothing, they're working on their computer and just making lactate like crazy. And then they go into the gym, and what do? They do lactate producing activities that contributes to that load and drives them further and further into a recovery deficit.
Right. So do you actually split up the anaerobic and aerobic exercises, or for an MMA or combat fight sports athlete, you sort of try and mix those and address them simultaneously?
Well, we can do it simultaneously, but it's more effective to look at what they need. So we'll start looking at things like heart rate variability. If their heart rate variability is trash, if they're not recovering, like you said, if you do some squats and you can't walk the next day and it takes a week for you to recover, we have to start thinking about, okay, what do we need to change to fix this? So one thing is making sure that their nervous system is in check so that they get in those recovery pathways. Making sure that you don't have any nutrient deficiencies like B1, B2, B3, B5, B6, B12. And that's, you know, high quality B vitamin is very, very cheap insurance, especially for athletes. So we encourage people to really look at those B vitamins, right?
Yeah.
And then just making sure, you know, if everything in the body works on a sliding scale. So if your body is way over an anaerobic land, so if you're complaining that you're overly sore, you're walking upstairs and your legs are burning already, I know you're stressed out, I know you're probably overtrained, you're not sleeping well, all right, well, what we're probably going to do is cut down on some of the anaerobic work, add in some aerobic work, and try to pull you back towards the middle a little bit.
All right.
If that makes sense, yeah.
So earlier on you mentioned resting heart rate, and you just referred to the heart rate variability again there. For fight athletes that are having a hard time in balancing their workload and perhaps are getting frustrated because they're not seeing results regardless of how hard they work, what would your recommendation be for where they should start?
So where they should start is actually measure it, right? Because the numbers won't lie. So we typically will use a Polar H7 heart rate monitor. I like the app for the smartphone Elite HRV, and we'll start taking their waking numbers. So I like the waking numbers because if you take it first thing in the morning, you haven't had any caffeine, you probably haven't had any stressful experiences, and that'll give you a lot of data on what's happening while they're asleep. And what we find a good majority of the time is, you know, we'll have somebody monitor that, and they'll call us the first day, and they're like, yeah, I had a waking heart rate of 85 and heart rate variability of 50, which basically a heart rate of 85 means that you think you're fighting an animal while you're trying to sleep, and no wonder you're getting up 800 times to pee and you can't sleep, and you don't wake up well rested, and you can't recover. So we start with the assessments, and then we start working from there.
So back to that, what gets measured gets managed.
Exactly. Exactly. And if you're not measuring it, you don't know. You don't know what's happening.
Yeah. Terrific.